This is 1A. Happy Friday. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. Labor Secretary Alexander Acosta has announced his resignation. This after an attempt at defending his role regarding a decades-old case he played a pivotal part in. California billionaire Tom Steyer changes his mind and has gone on attack, entering the race for president. Many Disney fans cheered news of two more live-action adaptations of animated classics and America's Champions come home.
We have to be better. We have to love more, hate less. We got to listen more and talk less. We got to know that this is everybody's responsibility. Every single person here. Every single person who's not here. Every single person who doesn't want to be here. Every single person who agrees and doesn't agree. It's our responsibility to make this world a better place.
That's Megan Rapinoe, the lavender-haired co-captain of the U.S. women's national soccer team. She spoke Wednesday in New York following a parade down Broadway to celebrate the team's latest World Cup win.
There's been so much contention in these last years. I've been a victim of that. I've been a perpetrator of that. With our fight with the Federation. Sorry for some of the things I said. Not all of the things. But it's time to come together. This conversation is at the next step.
And our conversation with the Friday News Roundup is just beginning. Joining us here to help make sense of this week's big stories is NPR's lead political editor, Domenico Montanaro. Domenico, welcome back to the Roundup.
Hey there. Thanks for having me.
Laura Meckler is a staff writer for The Washington Post. Welcome, Laura.
Thanks for having me.
And at NPR in New York, Ested Herndon is a national political reporter for The New York Times. Ested, thanks for making time for us.
Thank you for having me.
We want to make plenty of time for your questions and thoughts, so email us, 1A@WAMU.org, comment on our Facebook page, or tweet us at 1A. Would that we could spend the whole hour talking about the Women's World Cup, but there's a breaking story this morning out of the White House with which we must begin, involving Jeffrey Epstein and the Labor Secretary Alex Acosta. Epstein is well known in certain wealthy circles, and now he's a household name thanks to new federal charges of sex trafficking of underage girls that were filed against him in New York. Labor Secretary Acosta has become better known because of the Epstein case, but he will soon have a far lower profile. This morning, the White House announced that Acosta will resign, the aftermath of scrutiny he faced over Epstein's prosecution. Back in 2008, Epstein and the Miami U.S. Attorney's Office reached a deal to end a federal investigation of his involvement with at least 40 teenage girls. That ended with about a year in jail and the requirement for Epstein to register as a sex offender. At the time, Acosta was the U.S. attorney for South Florida. His critics claimed that he helped orchestrate a kind of sweetheart deal for Epstein. Secretary Acosta addressed that this week at a press conference.
I've seen the interviews on television of these victims and their stories. And so it's hard. But I also think it's important that we understand that the men and women of my office, going back to 2006 and 2007 and 2008, have spent their career prosecuting these types of cases. And in their heart, in our heart, we were trying to do the right thing for these victims.
That was Labor Secretary Acosta speaking at a press conference this week. Domenico, let me start with you. Can you give us a better sense of what was wrong in the eyes of Acosta's critics with this deal that he signed regarding Jeffrey Epstein?
Well, the deal that he signed was one that a lot of them, as you noted, they believed was a sweetheart deal, was something that he served less time than perhaps he would have if they, had prosecuted him to the fullest extent. Acosta tried to argue that it was a different time 12 years ago or 10 years ago, 11 years ago, that, you know, that their victim shaming was something that lawyers would do and that this was something that would be maybe a difficult case to win. There is a lot, though, that was reported in the Miami Herald, for example, last year about Acosta's role in this, about him stepping in. And the Palm Beach County state attorney had blamed Acosta for what he said was negotiating a deal and going over his head. Now, the police at the time blamed that same state attorney for quashing what they felt was could have been bigger charges. So there's a lot that was going on there. A lot of this was aired, but obviously got way more attention after the Epstein charges were the new ones were brought. It looked like Acosta was going to be able to hang on to his job, after his press conference that was encouraged by the White House to go ahead and do that. And then today, the White House is saying it was Acosta's choice to step down. This was not forced by the president, wasn't a result of the optics. You don't know what the reality is there necessarily, but from what they're saying, it was his choice.
And we should just be clear. We're talking about two sets of prosecutions. We're talking about Barry Kircher, who was the state attorney in Palm Beach County, Florida at the time. That's where the 13 months in jail in state in lockup took place. And then the federal prosecution, that's what Alexander Acosta was part of. He was the U.S. attorney for the Southern District of Florida. And that's the piece that Acosta is involved with. It's this overlap between the state prosecution and the federal prosecution. Laura, I wonder what you make of this public reckoning. He, in his statement, tried to explain his reasoning, but also was kind of hesitant to go too far because he said this is still an active federal prosecution now in New York.
I also think he was hesitant to go too far because the further you go, the more his actions get scrutinized of how he handled this. Because as you said, there were these state charges, but there also was a very robust federal investigation and indictment that was pending that he essentially let drop in lieu of the state charges, that those two separate prosecutions were wrapped up into one. I think that it was all becoming very uncomfortable for him. Now, this was known. Let's be clear that this admit was known when he was nominated for the post. It was talked about during his confirmation. But I think the whole thing, well, I know the whole thing became, you know, far more difficult for him and became a huge lightning rod when the new prosecutors, the federal prosecutors in New York this week, or was it last week, decided that on Monday he was arrested, that he was going to be prosecuted for very similar charges. So essentially now we have the prosecutors in New York saying, hey, look at what we found. They went to his house. They found hundreds, maybe thousands of pictures of nude girls. They found incredibly disturbing allegations from new sets of victims. And then the question became, well, Acosta, you were in charge of this at the time. Why didn't you push this harder? This is horrifying. And this was that spotlight shone on him so brightly.
The new allegations included from a woman named Jennifer Arose. She says she was a victim of Epstein's when she was 15 years old. Here is what she told NBC's Savannah Guthrie this week on Today.
Did Jeffrey Epstein rape you?
Yeah, no, he raped me. Forcefully raped me, but knew exactly what he was doing. And I don't think cared. What hurts even more so is that if I wasn't afraid to come forward sooner, then maybe he wouldn't have done it to other girls.
That was Jennifer Arose, who accuses Epstein of victimizing her when she was a teenager, speaking on Today on NBC. Astead Herndon, what about the fallout for the Trump administration? The president has defended Secretary Acosta in the past. Donald Trump also has past ties to Jeffrey Epstein. What about the fallout for the administration or potential fallout?
Yeah, we see this kind of cycle come up with this administration often. As cabinet officials are caught up in scandal, I can think back to Rob Porter. I can think back to kind of other administration officials who are caught up in more corruption scandals. You have this cycle that kind of develops. The president comes out and initially defends him, often because it seems to be that his instinct is to defend those who are on his team. And then as the scrutiny grows, as the headlines get worse, and that heat increases, the president turns on them or that person ends up stepping down. So even though a couple of days ago we had that press conference in which Secretary Acosta was defending himself and the White House was voicing support, those kind of keen followers of the White House should know that that doesn't often mean much. So it's no surprise that we kind of come to this point of his resignation today. I mean, I think when we look at the political fallout for the White House, it will not only be Secretary Acosta, but what about President Trump, who has his own relationship with Epstein? Is that something that can come up as this lawsuit develops? We don't know that. I think as you talk to kind of political folks, that's the bigger worry, is the president himself, seeing that they're now a little more capable of cutting ties with the secretary. But this is a scandal and a lawsuit that's going to wrap up a lot of different institutions, not just the White House. There are banks, there are financiers, there are New York circles that were all kind of involved in enabling this alleged predator for so long, and someone who was a registered sex offender for years. And so all of that, including the White House, is going to have to face the music as more facts develop.
Before we move on from this, Domenico, we haven't heard that much from Jeffrey Epstein or his legal team this week. We've heard mostly from Acosta, who's been trying to defend his actions, and also from Julie Brown, the investigative reporter from the Miami Herald, who blew this story open. But we haven't heard that much from Epstein in the last few days.
No, we haven't. And, you know, I think you would expect that he would lay low, given that any attorney would say in something like this that's this serious and this emotional and facing these kinds of charges that he should probably stay quiet. That's what they're probably advising him, and that's what I would expect.
One more story, just a quick mention involving a federal case of a high-profile man on sex charges. You may have heard that R. Kelly was arrested in Chicago yesterday on federal charges including child pornography, enticement of a minor, and obstruction of justice. More charges could come today. Kelly was taken into custody last night. He's being held at a correctional facility in Chicago. The allegations of sexual abuse against the 52-year-old singer date back to 1998. We'll continue the Friday News Roundup in just a minute with NPR's Domenico Montanaro, Laura Meckler of The Washington Post, and Ested Herndon of The New York Times. One more question about Acosta that we'd like to get to before we move on. Freedom to Be tweeted, "So Acosta has resigned. Nothing changes. We will not wake up a week from now and suddenly human trafficking victims can more easily pursue justice. The entire Labor Department is entrenched." I'd love your sense of what this means for the Department of Labor when we come back. We'll also check in on the Gulf, bracing for what could be a nasty storm this weekend. And we'll talk about a big casting announcement for a Disney remake. Maybe you'll recognize her voice. I'm Joshua Johnson, and this is 1A from WAMU and NPR. This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. The Gulf Coast is bracing for Tropical Storm Barry, the second named storm of this year's hurricane season. The National Hurricane Center says it's on track to make landfall on the Louisiana coast, possibly as a Category 1 hurricane. Forecasters expect strong winds and major water hazards, including one of the deadliest threats, storm surge. The flooding in New Orleans is already bad, but forecasters expect rivers in Louisiana to rise as much as 6 feet. It's the Friday News Roundup with Washington Post staff writer Laura Meckler, Ested Herndon, a national political reporter for The New York Times, and NPR's lead political editor Domenico Montanaro. Let's wrap up on Alex Acosta and Jeffrey Epstein before we move on. Wanda in Estero, Florida writes, "Why not give credit to the Miami Herald for their investigative reporting? They're the ones who brought this story back to life." Well said, Wanda. We have. And if you'd like to go back and listen to our conversation with Julie Brown of the Miami Herald, you'll find it online at the1a.org. But if ever there was a justification for subscribing to your local paper, just look at Julie Brown's work in the Miami Herald and then tell me it's not worth your money. Freedom to Be tweeted, "So Acosta has resigned. Nothing changes. We will not wake up a week from now and suddenly human trafficking victims can more easily pursue justice. The entire Labor Department is entrenched." Laura Meckler, what about that? Where does this go from here?
Well, I think the main implication for the Labor Department is that it'll be yet another cabinet agency that doesn't have a permanent leader. You know, Trump is going to have to find another nominee, going to have to get that person through the Senate. There's been an enormous amount of turnover in this administration, in the cabinet as well as in the White House itself. I think due to a variety of controversies that have come along and also due to the nature of the president's leadership and how he approaches his relationship with his top people, when they become difficult or there become problems, they seem to disappear. And that's what's happened here. So I think that there's, you know, no doubt that this will lead to some instability at the Labor Department. The deputy, it looks like, is going to be acting as the acting secretary. So presumably that person, you know, will keep the trains running on time and doing what they need to do. I think it's also notable that, you know, relations with labor and in terms of the work of labor unions is not exactly at the top of the Trump administration agenda. But there are, I believe, some questions there about how quickly they are going about rolling back some of the Obama initiatives that came out of the Labor Department. So we'll see if that might impede that progress even more.
And by the way, as for who the Deputy Secretary of Labor is, it's a man named Patrick Pizzella. He previously served on the Federal Labor Relations Authority under President Obama. Back in 2013, the president designated him acting FLRA chairman when he took office. Prior to that, he served under the George W. Bush administration, so got a little bit of experience serving both Democratic and Republican administrations. Let's move on and talk about immigration. Before we get to the matter of the census question, let's just look at the numbers of what's happening at the border. Instead, the latest numbers from the Department of Homeland Security show that arrests at the southwestern border dropped quite a bit by 28%. What do we make of that drop? Are fewer people coming? Is this just a blip? How do we read this?
It's hard to know. I mean, what we do know is that border arrests have been decreasing for a while. That was even true under the Obama administration. That could be because folks are feeling more comfortable in their home countries. That could be because of other reasons. The kind of measures that the Trump administration has put in may, you know, the kind of Republicans say that the president has deterred people from coming across. But what is clear is that the kind of crisis that the White House is articulating at the border doesn't necessarily always square with the facts. And we have those kind of lower number of entrants and lower number of arrests, which would seem as if that the massive amount of resources they are diverting to the border, the kind of state of emergency declared, that is why some Democrats say that those things are unnecessary. But we know, again, as on the kind of politics side where I sit, this is something that the White House has tried to use, to drive up interest from its base in both the midterm elections. They use the kind of coming, quote, unquote, a caravan of migrants to drive interest among their base to get to the polls. And we had that true in 2016 as well. And I think that everyone can kind of bet that if this White House plays the same political playbook it's looked at for the last couple years, as we ramp up into 2020 elections, it is likely to point to the border crisis to try to say that Democrats are, quote unquote, open borders candidates, which isn't really based in fact. But that's the political strategy just as much as it's a policy one.
Laura?
Well, everything that he says is absolutely right about how this has been played politically. But I think it's also important to note that the border apprehensions have really spiked in recent months. I mean, the numbers in May, which is the previous month that we had, had information for, were far higher than they've been for many, many years. I don't know if you remember, but in the Obama administration, there was a crisis with people coming to the border and unaccompanied children and families arriving at the border that spiked. Well, this is way higher than it was then. I mean, so the numbers have gone up. You know, the question is, you know, why? And I think that the answer is that there's continued violence in Central America. People want to leave. Obviously, the Trump policies actually, I don't think, have been working very well to discourage people from coming, as hard as they are trying to crack down on many, many different ways. But the numbers have been rising. And so what was notable in June is that they did drop. But keep in mind that even the June number is still far higher than it's been for at least the last five, six, 8 years. So and probably further back than that.
Domenico?
Those June numbers are actually the highest since 2004. Usually you do see a decline in summer months of border crossings because it's hot, right? And it makes it a lot harder to make that kind of travel across lots of places. And I think Laura's exactly right, that overall the trend is that you're seeing more people coming, and that has everything to do with the conditions in those countries. So when the administration wants to say the conditions that, you know, of arresting people, detaining them, all of that, while they think those things could potentially be deterrents, there's very little evidence that they actually are.
Let me stick with you, Domenico, for the announcement that the president made yesterday. He spoke from the Rose Garden and publicly backed off from his fight to add a citizenship question to the 2020 census. That had gone to the Supreme Court, and justices ruled that the administration could not add the question unless it could give a stronger, more defensible reason for why it needed to be there. The president says that instead he's going to seek information from existing documentation that other federal agencies collect to kind of get at the same goal of figuring out how many undocumented immigrants are in the U.S. What does that mean going forward? I mean, can those data be used for immigration enforcement?
Well, first of all, the president wound up coming to a conclusion yesterday that all of us knew 2 weeks ago. He essentially threatened to put this back on the census in some way. He even mentioned a rationale that most people thought was the real rationale, which was wanting to use this for redistricting. It was not the rationale that was used by the administration before the Supreme Court. And I think that's really important because when you look at redistricting, redistricting is meant to be done by counting all persons who reside in the United States. It's not intended to be done based on citizens. Now, that appears to be what the president wanted to do. He's still sort of making a vague threat that states can use the citizenship data to determine their apportionment. But the way apportionment works is, one, it's based on the census, but also on the same day of that census ruling by the Supreme Court, it also said that the federal courts have no role in controlling gerrymandering, the process by which there's political redistricting. So we're in the Wild West. These states are going to be allowed to continue to do whatever it is they want as far as how to gerrymander, how to draw these districts in ways that benefit them politically. State legislatures are allowed to do that. And the places that have total control by one party or another are going to be able to gerrymander to their heart's delight.
To the point you made, Domenico, about border crossings, Jerry is listening from State College, Pennsylvania. And Jerry writes, as someone who worked on the border for two decades, I can tell you this. In June, daytime temperatures frequently rise above 100 degrees. Apprehensions by the Border Patrol have long dropped throughout the summer months. Instead, with regard to apprehensions, that's one thing that the administration is not backing off on, these immigration raids that had been announced. And according to the Times, sources say that the raids are set to start taking place this Sunday. What do we know about what's going to go on with these raids? There had been some contradictory claims as to whether or not it's even going to happen.
Yeah, it's hard to know exactly. I mean, the reports coming out of multiple outlets were that the administration had targeted these kind of increase in apprehensions for a while. There was kind of reports about it some months ago that was then put off. There is now some saying that the kind of scope and scale and target of these are, again, under question. But what we do know is that the administration has for some time wanted a quote-unquote like show of force around the issue and wanted to particularly target communities and cities that were largely Democratic or urban centers. And so that's the kind of extent to the kind of factual questions we know for sure about this. But again, I would point back to the kind of political ones. I mean, this has been an administration that has tried to use these more dramatic instances to drive interest among their political base that has not necessarily been reflected in the need for in the kind of policy need, right? Like there is not a lot of evidence that these type of raids would make these communities safer or are coming from a place where the community or local officials want them. This is a federally dictated or White House-driven policy or show that is meant to drive interest and that is meant to kind of show the administration speak to their own group of supporters to say that they are accomplishing the kind of the mandate that they feel that they were sent to do.
Laura, here's a quick clip of the acting head of U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, Ken Cuccinelli. He spoke to reporters on Wednesday. Here he is responding to a question about the specifics of the raids.
Yeah, well, we're not going to say when operational elements are going to roll out. And Matt Albans is in control of that at ICE, career man. And,
are they
going to
happen?
They're absolutely going to happen. There's approximately a million people in this country with removal orders. Of course, that isn't what ICE will go after in this. But that's the pool of people who've been all the way through the due process chain.
That's Ken Cuccinelli, the acting head of U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services. Worth noting, Laura, there are still quite a few Americans who believe that this enforcement is necessary, who are convinced that the southern border is unruly, that more does need to be done to control the flow of migrants through the southern border, despite what they're going through on a humanitarian effort. You know, the build the wall rhetoric still exists to an extent. I'm not sure what your I wonder what your take is on the politics of this and whether any Republicans are really worried about the implication of this messaging.
Well, let's keep in mind what they mean when they say a final order of removal. Those are people who have often had claims that were litigated through the immigration courts, and a court has ordered them deported. So from the Trump administration point of view, and from the point of view of people who believe that we need to put an end to illegal immigration, if you don't then deport people who have been ordered removed, there's very little incentive not to try your hand at crossing the border. Because what happens is most people who come across the border quote, illegally, they're not actually sneaking across the border or trying to evade Border Patrol. They're not, you know, just sneaking in and then disappearing into the country. For the most part, they're showing up and they're turning themselves into border agents. Why are they doing that? Because they believe they'll ultimately get to stay. And if you don't, in fact, remove people who have final orders of removal, they're right. They will get to stay. So that is the argument for executing this. Now, the question, though, becomes, we have approximately 11 million undocumented immigrants in the U.S. What are your priorities? Now, under the Obama administration, they limited enforcement basically to people with serious criminal records. What Trump is viewing it much more broadly, going after people with these final order of removals. And we should add another group, too, which is people they happen to encounter when they're out in the field. Let's say they're targeting dad who has a final order of removal, but his wife is with him or a neighbor happens to be there and those people are undocumented. Doesn't matter whether if they're still here illegally and they don't have a right to stay, they might get swooped up as well. So it is a much more aggressive approach. It's one that obviously Trump supporters very much support.
We're speaking to Laura Meckler of The Washington Post, Ested Herndon of The New York Times, and NPR's Domenico Montanaro. We welcome your questions and thoughts about this week's top stories, 1A at WAMU.org. Tweet us at 1A or comment on our Facebook page. Speaking of Twitter, Domenico, there were a few stories involving the president and social media this week. And a little advice for when those internet trolls and Twitter haters get too loud, usually you block them. For most people, that's not a problem. But for President Trump, it's a little different. On Tuesday, an appeals court ruled that for the president to block his critics on Twitter is unconstitutional. Now, there's a similar lawsuit that's been filed against New York Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Yesterday, the president held what he called a social media summit at the White House, not including Facebook and Twitter representatives, but a number of far-right social media influencers who claim that they've been treated unfairly by Twitter, Facebook, and others. Now, we should be clear. The First Amendment does not govern Twitter and Facebook. They have the legal right to block whoever they want or to restrict whoever they want. The issue is whether the president, in his authority as the chief executive of the U.S., can block critics. What does this mean for the president's relationship with social media?
Well, it means that he can't block people. And, you know, the fact is, I don't know, I'm like Dikembe Mutombo on Twitter, man. Like, they come at me, they're not getting to the room. You know what I mean? Like, they're blocked. But
it's better just block them.
Just, you know.
Right.
But at the same time, I understand the instinct to do that. But what the court is saying here about the president is that because of his perch and who he is, that he's not going to be able to shut off people from actually seeing what is a vital communication to people. You know, when I talk to reporters about and other editors about whether or not we should be covering the president's tweets, we shouldn't go overboard with the tweets, but the tweets are a presidential statement. And, you know, it's like if the president were to set up a microphone on some street corner in Washington, D.C. and make a statement, you can bet cameras will be there. You can bet people will listen. You might not air them necessarily, but the court is essentially saying that everybody in the country has the right to at least hear what that statement is.
In fact, if you go to the official presidential Twitter feed at POTUS, it says tweets archived, and it says that these are going to be preserved for posterity. But Domenico, I don't think we expect this to change the president's Twitter practices.
Well, he might have to not block people or unblock them. Certainly those who were, sued over this are, you know, have a case to say that they need to be able to follow him now.
Much more we want to discuss as we continue the roundup with Domenico Montanaro, Laura Meckler, and Ested Herndon. We want to talk about a case against the Affordable Care Act that's being argued in New Orleans, and much more to discuss about the 2020 field of presidential candidates. Before we pause, here's one other story that caught our eye this week. You know, they say that content is king, and the newly formed conglomerate Warner Media is taking back some of its hit content for a new streaming service. Next year, Warner will move the hit sitcom Friends off Netflix to its new service called HBO Max. Friends is one of the top streamed shows on Netflix, but Warner Media owns Warner Brothers, which produced Friends. A lot of media companies are quickly building streaming services to try to out Netflix, including Disney Plus, CBS All Access, and an upcoming service from NBC Universal. We're back to the roundup in just a minute. Stay close. I'll be there for you. Back now to the roundup with Ested Herndon of the New York Times, NPR's Domenico Montanaro, and Laura Meckler of the Washington Post. Laura, let me come to you and talk about the Affordable Care Act. There's another court challenge in a federal appeals court in New Orleans that could affect coverage for millions of Americans, similar to a previous prosecution. On Tuesday, two of the three judges on the three-judge panel gave the appearance that they might side with a lower court judge. The lower court ruled that the ACA was unconstitutional. That was back in Texas. And the decision could determine whether the case goes back to the Supreme Court. I don't want to read too deeply into what this appeals court case could mean, but what are some of the possibilities depending on how this shakes out?
Well, there are a few possibilities. One, of course, is they could say that, yes, the law is completely constitutional. I don't think didn't look that way from the arguments, but you never know, overrule the lower court entirely. The court could just say that the individual mandate, the requirement that all Americans carry health insurance, is unconstitutional. Now, the heart of that traces back, if we recall, when the Supreme Court somewhat surprisingly rescued and saved the Affordable Care Act in 2012, they did so on the logic that it was a tax, that Congress is allowed to impose a tax, and that's what the mandate was. It was, if you do not have insurance, you pay this penalty or this tax. Well, through the tax bill under Trump, that penalty was reduced to zero. So we really don't have a tax anymore. So the question before the court now is, okay, there is really no tax. So under the Supreme Court ruling, does that mean the mandate goes away? So the court could just say the mandate goes away, but the rest of the law stays. Or they could agree with the lower court and invalidate the entire law. They say, you know, that, and this has been an argument that's been made by people on both sides of this issue, that the pieces of the law interfit with each other and interact, and you can't just pull one of them out. And I would just highlight one very important provision of the law that is closely tied to the mandate, which is the requirement that insurance companies cover people even if they have pre-existing conditions. The argument long has been made by health policy experts and others that you can't ask insurance companies to cover everybody if you don't have a requirement that people have insurance. Otherwise, you know, somebody finds out they're very sick and goes out and buys insurance.
Right.
Well, the insurance system doesn't work very well if that's the case. So that part could, and that's the most popular part of the law, is this requirement that you hold, that you recover people with pre-existing conditions, one of the most popular. So I think that this is a puzzle, and I think that the appellate court will see whether they invalidate the mandate, invalidate the entire thing.
Carrie writes, I live in Texas, and the only way I can afford insurance is through the ACA. He, meaning President Trump, he wants to get rid of it so bad, but why doesn't he offer something to take its place instead of just leaving me and a million other people in Texas stranded? Ested Herndon, I wanted to come to you on a similar point. We know that the administration tried at the very beginning of its time to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act. That went through Congress multiple times and never quite succeeded. But now on the campaign trail among the Democrats, I'm hearing less about the Affordable Care Act, although they do talk about defending it, and much more about what the next phase should be, a public option, Medicare for all. It seems like health care is a big issue for 2020, but the Affordable Care Act is now just a piece of that.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. I mean, what is true now that was true 2 years ago and will be true in 2020 is that healthcare is probably the top domestic policy issue among voters. How that is articulated depends on candidate to candidate. In the last Democratic debate, you had a kind of split emerging that's true on the campaign trail also among Democrats who more vocally want to look at a single payer, Medicare for all option. That is mostly Senator Bernie Sanders, Senator Elizabeth Warren, and then sometimes Kamala Harris, depending on how you read her statements. And the Democrats who want to build on the Affordable Care Act and kind of phase in a Medicare for all option. And then some who just reject that idea and are looking at things like a public option or a Medicare buy-in program or the like. But what you do have, I think, is to the point you're saying, is Democrats talking about ways the Affordable Care Act did not solve the problems of cost and access for all Americans. And what is the best way to go about that in the coming year? So I think what was the lesson that Democrats and Republicans evidence took from the Trump administration's efforts to roll back the Affordable Care Act was, one, you cannot just repeal, right? Republicans had that mantra for years and years about repeal and replace, and it was a lot easier in word than in actual action. When they tried to get to the point of rolling back the of repealing the Affordable Care Act by itself, people like the listener who just wrote in were wondering, well, what happens to my insurance that I got through that plan? And when they tried to find solutions, those were not ones that the Congress could agree on. So what Democrats are trying to do is actually have a replacement option that grows the amount of people covered. Who and what that option should be depends on the candidate.
Domenico?
You know, stepping back to look at the sort of landscape, bigger picture of the intersection between politics and the law, what we're seeing with this case kind of coming back and conservatives kind of flexing their muscles and saying, hey, let's get this back to the Supreme Court. It's really indicative of where we're at and the fact that this could be the courts could be the biggest legacy consequentially of what President Trump leaves behind when he leaves office. Mitch McConnell laid the groundwork for him, the Republican Senate leader, when he blocked numbers of President Obama's federal judges. President Trump has been able to push those through with McConnell's help at record rates, and now he also has a conservative majority at the Supreme Court. So all of this groundwork has been laid, and it's going to be very difficult for Democrats to turn that aircraft carrier around.
Speaking of the Democrats, let's talk about the field of Democrats running for president, because this week that field grew by one and shrank by one. Congressman Eric Swalwell, who represents part of the Bay Area, announced that he is pulling out of the race.
We have to be honest about our own candidacy's viability. Today ends our presidential campaign.
But another Californian, billionaire philanthropist Tom Steyer, made an announcement of his own.
If you think that there's something absolutely critical, try as hard as you can and let the chips fall where they may. And that's exactly what I'm doing. My name's Tom Steyer. I'm running for president.
Laura, what do we make of Swalwell's departure and Steyer's entry? We asked Tom Steyer on this program in the past whether he was thinking about running for office, and he was kind of cagey, and I guess now we understand
why.
Right.
Exactly. Well, cagey is better than, you know, denying it and then doing it anyway. Well, there you go. You know, I think that Monday began when we found out that Swalwell was leaving with the, you know, the political world being like, okay, maybe this race is going to start getting moving towards a little more under control in terms of the number of candidates. And then by day's end, we had another one, which, you know, answering the Democrats, you know, coast to coast desire for more for more choices. I think that he has another voice. He's a billionaire. He has a ton of money. He has mostly made his name in recently with calls and a lot of money behind ads urging the impeachment of Donald Trump. So I think that we should definitely expect that issue to get injected into the Democratic race. It's not necessarily something everybody wants to talk about.
Well, if he qualifies for debates, and you know, the next round of he would need 65,000 donors within the next, what day is today? Within the next four days?
I don't think he's going to make that.
Yeah.
I mean, nobody, I mean, you know, he's got one himself, but, you know, maybe that's not really.
He makes
really,
65,000 deposits.
Yeah, I don't think he could do it that way. So, no, I don't think he'll be in this debate. But, you know, if he sticks around and he makes it to the next debate, and if his voice becomes one that's part of this conversation, I think the impeachment discussion may heat up a little bit.
Domenico?
I think unquestionably this race is going to be filtering very quickly down to a very solid top tier of candidates. The Democratic National Committee has doubled the standards for the fall to get on the debate stage in September. You're going to need at least 2% in the polls, 130,000 donors. There are not a lot of candidates who are meeting that, despite there being two dozen candidates in the race. The only ones right now who look like they could definitely make it are Joe Biden, Elizabeth Warren, Kamala Harris, Bernie Sanders, and Pete Buttigieg. That is a difficult bar, then. We're looking at that as a pretty distinct top tier compared to saying, wow, there's so many candidates in the race.
But hey, that shrinks the field, right? As opposed to like two nights of 10 people, one night of five people.
Yeah.
It might not be great for ad revenue, but you know, that's the network's problem. So Tom Steyer may or may not qualify for these debates. As you mentioned, Domenico, there may be five or fewer who are qualifying at this point, but we should reflect back on another presidential debate from back in 1992. Remember Ross Perot? that third-party candidate who shared the stage with Bill Clinton and George H.W. Bush, it became a career-defining night for Perot. And this week, he passed away, died from leukemia at the age of 89. Perot was a billionaire, a Texas tycoon who got 19% of the vote in 92. It was the strongest showing for a third-party candidate in the past 80 years. Now, we still feel the influence of some of his ideas and his rhetoric, which takes us back to that 1992 debate. Here is what Ross Perot famously had to say about NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement.
You can move your factory south of the border, pay a dollar an hour for your labor, have no health care, that's the most expensive single element making a car, have no environmental controls, no pollution controls, and no retirement, and you don't care about anything but making money. There will be a giant sucking sound going south. So if the people send me to Washington, the first thing I'll do is study that 2,000-page agreement and make sure it's a two-way street.
That was Ross Perot talking about NAFTA during the 1992 presidential debate. He died this week at the age of 89. We're winding down, but let's talk about the economy. Stocks hit a new record high this week after the Federal Reserve Chairman, Jerome Powell, testified before Congress about the challenges facing the U.S. economy. Here's part of what he said on Wednesday to the House Financial Services Committee.
Our baseline outlook is for economic growth to remain solid, labor markets to stay strong, and inflation to move back up over time to the committee's 2% objective. However, uncertainties about the outlook have increased in recent months. In particular, economic momentum appears to have slowed in some major foreign economies, and that weakness could affect the U.S. economy. Moreover, a number of government policy issues have yet to be resolved, including trade developments, the federal debt ceiling, and Brexit. And there is a risk that weak inflation will be even more persistent than we currently anticipate. We're carefully monitoring these developments and will continue to assess their implications for the U.S. economic outlook and inflation.
That was Fed Chairman Jerome Powell speaking on Wednesday to the House Financial Services Committee. Instead, Herndon, there's so much to potentially pay attention to. You know, Fed Chairman and Chairwomen always choose their words super duper carefully. Jerome Powell has been something of a political football for Donald Trump lately. The markets like the way things are going, but as Kai Rizdahl of Marketplace is fond of saying, the markets are not the economy. What should we be paying attention to?
Well, I think this is one of a kind of myriad of factors that play into the kind of the way we will look at this. I mean, certainly, as you have said, the White House has tried to rein in Jerome Powell and tried to kind of exert its influence and tried to tell a very specific story about the economy, tell one that looks at those kind of macro numbers and tells one that that continues the economic growth that started during the Obama administration. But there are some who say that, like, those numbers are kind of hiding a coming kind of retrenchment. And so I don't think we necessarily know or can predict kind of where this is going. But I can say, as someone who spends a lot of time on the Democratic campaign trail, there's two different stories of the economy you are going to hear over the next year from the different political parties. One that says that there has been the type of robust growth, again, using the kind of decrease in unemployment numbers and the like. And then one that tries to tell a story about inequality, tells a story that's saying that that type of growth has not reached the most disenfranchised communities and not reached the kind of communities that the president said he would uplift. And so where has that gone to? Where has the economic growth gone to is going to be one question, but also, is it sustained? Whether this president goes into the next year with a more robust economy is a big difference than if he goes into one where it seems as if that growth is starting to dial back.
And Laura, briefly before we move on, what's to blame for the weak economic growth? What do we expect to be discussed as we get closer to the election, for example? I mean, the tariff war with China or?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the questions of trade are huge. And as Chairman Powell said in the clip that you played, you know, that is still unresolved. We know wages often is an issue that people pay attention to. You know, it's one thing for corporate profits to be up, and the tax bill delivered quite a bit of money to shareholders. But and we should note that the stock market is at an all-time high. I mean, that part is doing great, but is that working its way down to everyday Americans? I think when you talk about politics, that you always have to talk about that.
One last story that I think a lot of everyday Americans will appreciate, especially those of us who grew up in the 90s with lots of great Disney movies. There are some more live-action adaptations on the way. Last week, Disney dropped a trailer for a new Mulan. A few days before that, we learned that the casting for the lead role for an adaptation of The Little Mermaid was completed. Singer-songwriter Halle Bailey will play Ariel, not Halle Berry. Halle Bailey. She came to prominence as half of the R&B duo Chloe and Halle. She's been performing with her sister since before they debuted on YouTube at ages 11 and 13. Their album was nominated for 2 Grammys. They've toured with Beyonce and Jay-Z. And speaking of the Queen Bee, she is getting kudos for her role as Nala in the upcoming live-action remake of The Lion King. That drops next Friday. This week, the first song from Beyonce's new album, based on the movie, dropped this week. It is called Spirit, from the album The Lion King, The Gift. And as we leave you with the song Spirit, we say thank you to Laura Meckler, a reporter for The Washington Post. Laura, thanks for spending the hour with us.
Great to be here.
Ested Herndon, national political reporter for The New York Times. Thank you, Ested.
Thank you.
And NPR's lead political editor, Domenico Montanaro. Domenico, thank you.
You're so welcome.
1A's lead audio engineer is Jake Cherry, with technical help from Josephine Neonai. Our digital team is Gabrielle Healy and Catherine Fink. To learn more about our team, visit the1a.org/staff. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thanks for listening and enjoy your weekend. This is 1A.